The Irish Times and Irish Examiner both lead today with government plans to introduce tighter travel restrictions. We're told that ministers will today examine whether to intensify checks on people quarantining at home after travel, with fines under consideration for those found not to be complying with stay-at-home obligations. It's also reported that Tánais Dlí of Oiradgur has said that a limited mandatory hotel quarantine for those arriving in the state without a negative test result or from COVID-19 hotspots may be extended if it's approved today by the Cabinet's COVID subcommittee. For its lead story, the Irish Independent reports on central bank figures on the counties that have been hardest hit by the pandemic. Kerry, which has a high dependency on tourism, was the county which was worst affected, with an unemployment rate of 25%, compared with 17% in Cork, where more people work in manufacturing. The Irish Daily Mail leads with the story about an unnamed NHS doctor who was turned away from a Ryanair flight from London to Dublin on Saturday, despite having a negative PCR test, which he had done with the NHS. Ronan Smith reports that Ryanair staff insisted that the man needed a private test result to fly and that he was one of nine people turned away from the flight. Comments made by HSE boss Paul Reid on RTÉ's This Week programme yesterday, in which he says that eight hospitals have reached capacity and that there are only 24 ICU beds available in the system, generates the lead story in today's Irish Daily Mirror. For its lead story, the Irish Daily Star reports on an incident at a checkpoint in Donegal town yesterday afternoon, which resulted in Gardaí chasing a car which failed to pull over when requested, and the arrest of four people, two men and two women, who were subsequently released from Ballyshannon Garda station. And that paper also reports that Gardaí issued fixed penalty notices to 10 people who were found drinking in an illegal shebeen in an industrial premises in Swords in North County Dublin on Saturday night. As for on the front pages, the Irish News leads with political reaction to the Lucid Talk poll carried in the Sunday Times yesterday, which found that 51% of those surveyed would favour a border poll within the next 5 years. The Belfast Telegraph leads with the line that trusts in Northern Ireland are facing medical negligence cases which date back as far as the 1960s. McGregor's €6 million kicking. That's the lead headline in today's Irish Sun, which reports on how much money Conor McGregor is likely to earn despite suffering his first ever knockout in an MMA fight over the weekend. The picture on the front of today's Examiner is of the Lizard Estate in West Cork, which has just been sold to US buyers for an estimated €3.5 million. And finally, the weekend snowfall features in pictures on the front of two of today's papers. The Independent runs with an action shot taken by Dominic Walsh of snowboarder Jessica Murphy in mid-jump on the Stax Mountains near Tralee, County Kerry, while Brian Lawless's picture on the front of the Times shows two women about to take a dip off the Bull Wall in Dublin in the middle of a snow shower.
It's a new week, but in many ways it's the same story continuing to dominate the political agenda. There are positives. Adherence to level 5 restrictions has driven the daily COVID numbers below 2,000. Yesterday, 1,373. But pressure continues on hospitals and ICUs, and there is still, the CMO emphasised, a huge volume of disease in the community. This week, the government faces another series of big decisions, including mandatory quarantine for people travelling into Ireland, the reopening of schools and the vaccine rollout. Our political editor David Murphy joins us. And David, there will be no surprise in decisions to be made this week on continuing level 5 restrictions. I think that's already very well flagged. But there are additional and new decisions to be made around travel and around quarantine. What can you tell us?
Well, Mary, what we understand is that there is going to be mandatory testing for people coming in from Brazil and South Africa and possibly other South American countries which have been affected by the new strain of the virus. There'll also be mandatory testing. Mandatory quarantine, I should say, for anyone without a negative COVID-19 test. The other thing the government will be looking at is the question of using enhanced use of the passenger locator forms. These are the forms that people fill out when they're coming into the country. So to ensure that people who do have to restrict their movements, self-isolate, that they are doing so. Also, the other issue that will be discussed by ministers at the Cabinet subcommittee meeting this afternoon is the question of slimming down the definition of essential workers. So at the moment, people are allowed to come in if they are essential workers, to have a look at those definitions and to see if that can be tightened up in any way. And we've got to remember that normally through our airports we have around 90,000 people coming in. This is pre-COVID. That fell dramatically to around 10,000. It's now around 1,000 a day. Whether or not that 1,000 can be reduced any further. And the other issue is visa restrictions. So these are all proposals which will be discussed by ministers today. They've to reach some conclusions. Then there'll be a full cabinet meeting tomorrow to discuss the proposals, to see if there will be agreement on that. But a lot of these issues are focusing on the people coming in into our airports, into our ports, to tighten up on that, to ensure there's further protection in terms of COVID-19. It doesn't deal with the issue of people coming over the border.
Yeah. Is there any, and I'll come back to that in a moment, and about the sharing of information north and south, but is there any greater clarity on how this quarantining might work? And the Taoiseach, you know, talking around a 5-day quarantine, but would it be 5 days, 10 days, or could it be 14 days? And who pays?
Well, I think those type of details are going to be discussed this afternoon by ministers. Obviously, there's concerns that if it's just 5 days, and this has been expressed by a number of medics over the weekend, that if it's just 5 days, that won't be lengthy enough. So this is something they're going to have to discuss. Also, the issue of payment will have to be discussed. And I think as well that the cabinet subcommittee meeting today will also be looking at the question of schools in a lot of detail.
Now, the question of travel north and south, Alan Kelly yesterday talking about policing around 5K from the border, and a lot of criticism north of the border on a failure by government here to share information on these locator forms coming into the country. So can we expect some developments in this area?
Well, last week in the Dáil, Taoiseach Minister Leo Varadkar did say that there was an intention to share data. He said that there was difficulties around that at the moment, but that's something that they were hoping to move towards. The authorities in the north have raised questions about this, saying that they haven't got all the information regarding people coming into the country that they would wish. So I think that's something that they will move on.
Now, the other big question, which there is a growing demand for decisions to be made on, one is special education and the need to get some reopening of education for children with additional needs, and the other, the leaving cert.
So I think that there's been a general concern within government over the past week or so that too much of the negotiations between the teachers' unions and government was being done over the airwaves. And what they're doing now is they're having confidential talks and they're trying not to comment on exactly what's going on. But what we do know, and a lot of this was spelt out by the Taoiseach over the weekend, is the first priority is to try to get education of children with special needs up and running. The next immediate priority is to try to get teaching of Leaving Cert students back underway, and as part of that, at least agree some sort of plan regarding the Leaving Cert. The Labour leader, Alan Kelly, was very clear that he didn't really believe that the sit-down Leaving Cert exam is going to happen this year. Speaking to people in government over the weekend, I don't get the sense that they have agreed that there won't be a Leaving Cert exam this year, and there many of them are determined to try to ensure that it does go ahead this year. The other issue is then, what about the rest of the schools? The interesting comment from the Taoiseach over the weekend was that the rest of the 1 million students who attend school won't be back before St. Patrick's Day. It's more likely we'll see a staggered approach in terms of the return of schools.
And a final issue still on the government agenda, it doesn't go away, the paediatric children's hospital, and the announcement that Fred Barry appointed as the chair of the development board in 2019, that he intends to resign. He's tendered his resignation.
That's right. So this is the board that oversees the development of the Children's Hospital. Obviously, it's been subject to very significant cost overruns. It's been subject to delays. So he was brought in 2 years ago to oversee the development. The department and the board of the hospital have issued a statement saying that he's going to be standing down. Obviously, he was seen as a very steady hand. He's someone who in the past has run the National Transport Authority.
Do we know at this stage if there are further overruns on spending now in the National Children's Hospital and delays because of COVID?
So what we've seen in the past is that work did stop on the Children's Hospital. It then has recommenced because it's been classified as essential construction. But obviously that's going to have some sort of impact in terms of the development of the hospital. But it's fairly clear the government have it at the top of its agenda in terms of ensuring that it is included in terms of essential construction. But I think all construction has been affected by, for instance, the social distancing and the other rules.
All right, David Murphy, our political editor, thank you.
Frontline workers in hospital who were expecting to get their first dose of the vaccine this week will have to wait. A reduction in supply means that the HSE will use existing doses to complete the vaccination programme for those frontline staff who have already had their first jab. Nursing home residents and those in long-term stay will also get their second dose. The decision has led to criticism from those working at the coalface of this pandemic. Dr. Matthew Sadlier is a member of the IMO's Consultant Committee and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Are we talking here thousands of frontline workers who will have to wait until the first or second week of February for their first dose of the vaccine?
Well, I think essentially the problem is we don't know. And I think the problem is that we would like to know. I mean, the issue here today is about trying to protect staff and to allow the hospitals to continue to function, because obviously the hospitals can't work if we don't have staff. At this moment in time, there's approximately 6,000 staff who are off work because of issues related to COVID. And it's not acceptable that we have not got a plan that is vaccinating those who have face-to-face patient contact as the priority within the hospital service. And what we are calling on is that we get a transparency as about who has been vaccinated and how many people who are involved in face-to-face contact are still left to be vaccinated.
Yes, because the HSE say that all those working in COVID wards are in they're first on the priority list. But are you saying you don't know if all of those people, whether consultants, junior doctors, nurses, respiratory physios, radiographers, porters, cleaners, all of those who come into direct contact with COVID patients have been vaccinated first?
Well, I think the difficulty that we're facing at the moment is that, you know, we've almost 2,000 patients in hospitals with COVID. So every ward is now a COVID ward. And we've seen COVID outbreaks happen in hospitals. We've seen them happen in mental health units. We've seen them happen in other units. So the concept that, you know, that you can say that there's some areas of the hospitals are affected by COVID and others aren't, at this point where we are, is not true. I mean, every part of the hospital and everybody who's face-to-face contact with patients is at risk. And we've seen that with the very high numbers of staff who have been affected and who are currently off work.
But given the reduced supplies in the vaccine, particularly on the part of AstraZeneca, we had that announcement over the weekend, significant reductions they expect in their supplies. What should the HSE have done?
Well, I think we knew that there was going to be a vaccination campaign. We knew from whenever, last October, November, there was going to be a vaccination campaign. So, I mean, what we should have done, and I know it's spilt milk and all that, is we should have had a very definitive list in every hospital, in every service, that should have been worked out over the last 2 months, rather than trying to put together a list of the staff who needed vaccination and a list of how we were going to deliver this vaccination over the last 2 to 3 weeks once vaccination supplies came into the country. Yes, we are, and I do have sympathy with the HSE that, you know, if you've 100,000 people to be vaccinated and you've only 70,000 vaccines, there will be a shortfall. But it's to ensure that those that who were at most risk, who we need to protect, because it must be said that protecting staff means protecting patients. And if we don't have staff in the hospitals able to man our ICUs, able to man our emergency departments, then we won't be able to treat patients who have this disease and other diseases adequately. So that is what we were calling for. But so I suppose at this point, what we need to have is some transparency over where are we going from now and who has been vaccinated, who is left to be vaccinated, and how we can manage that best going forward.
But do you think they should have taken an approach like the UK has done and given significant protection to 100% of frontline workers, i.e. give them the first jab, rather than having full protection for 50% of frontline workers through two jabs?
Well, that's a very difficult question. I know that has been questioned even within the UK by a number of the medical colleges as to whether or not they should have broken with the regulations that came from the vaccine manufacturers. I think it's a very difficult question. I suppose my own attitude will be that you need to follow the instructions from the vaccine manufacturers, because all we know is that the vaccine gives protection if it is given within the time frames that were used in the clinical trial. So breaking that regulation would have taken, you know, would be something that would be a kind of a high risk thing to do. And I think, as you say, it is questioned what the UK has done over that. So I wouldn't have a specific answer for you.
OK, well, in relation to PPE, because the INMO, the Nurses and Midwives Organisation, over the weekend said that they were very concerned over not being given the high grade masks, the FFP2 masks, to their staff despite asking for them. Now, the HSE has said there's no reason why hospitals cannot and should not be giving, should be giving these masks to their staff. What's your experience of PPE?
Well, our experience is very similar to the INMO, that, you know, as I said earlier, at this point in time, with 2,000 patients with COVID in the hospitals, all interactions in the hospitals have to be seen as high risk at this point in time. And we would also be calling that FFP2 and the higher grade masks are available for staff when they're interacting in face-to-face contact with patients. At this point in time, they are available, and we've yet to see a shortage. But at the same time, they are not the standard usage mask that is being advised to be used at all patient interactions. And what has been said is that they will be available if people have risk assessments performed towards the action they're doing. Now, what we are saying is that at this point in the pandemic, all interactions with patients are high risk. The COVID is incredibly prevalent across the hospital system, and as such, these masks need to be guaranteed to be available for staff engaging in all face-to-face patient contact.
Okay, thank you for talking to us this morning, Dr. Matthew Sadlier, who's a member of the Irish Medical Organisations Consultant Committee. It's 25 past seven.
News from the UK this morning that Boohoo has purchased the brand of collapsed department store group Debenhams for £55 million. But the online retailer will not be taking on any of the company's stores or its workforce. Irish startup Luna has teamed up with Zip Mobility to roll out smarter electric scooters. The partnership is one of a number of deals agreed by e-scooter operators for Luna's groundbreaking technology, which uses artificial intelligence and camera technology to ensure better safety. Showcase, one of the largest international trade fairs where designers and craft makers show their collections to buyers from across the globe, gets underway today. Normally the event is held in the RDS, but this year it's hosting its first ever virtual showrooms. On the currencies, €1 buys 88.8 pence sterling and $1.22.
EU foreign ministers, including Simon Coveney, will discuss the imprisonment of the jailed Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny today. Russian police have detained more than 3,000 people in a crackdown on protests in support of Navalny, who was detained on his return to the country last weekend after treatment in Germany for a near-fatal poisoning with the nerve agent Novichok. The Kremlin rejects Navalny's claim that President Putin ordered the attack. Sarah Rainsford is the BBC Moscow correspondent. And Sarah, protesters came out in numbers defying that the ban, the fears of COVID and restrictions and freezing temperatures. Is it fair to say now that this is very worrying for the Kremlin and the crackdown was swift?
Well, yes, I think that the numbers were significant and the Kremlin will certainly be watching to see how this develops. I think the aim of Alexei Navalny, who actually called for these protests across the country himself from his court hearing when he was remanded in custody on arriving back in Moscow, he wanted people to come out right across the country. And they did, from the far, far east in freezing temperatures, minus 50 in some places, to here in Moscow and up in St. Petersburg, where there were really big crowds, the biggest crowds here in the capital. I was on Pushkin Square on Saturday. There was a huge crowd there, packed into the square itself and into the pavements too. A lot of riot police. At the beginning, they were sweeping in and they were picking people out of the crowd, apparently at random, and detaining them. But a bit later, they then basically tried to clear the square, and there was lots of people detained then. I think the number now is around about 3,500 right across the country. So the biggest number of people being detained, which shows, I think, the concern of the authorities here to try to nip this in the bud. They really don't want there to be a wave of massive protests because they fear the streets here in Russia, I think, the Kremlin does. It's concerned about the pull and the power that Alexei Navalny has, his influence even behind bars. So I think they're watching very carefully and thinking about how they move next.
They are rallying to Navalny at the moment. And the question is, does he have a plan? Because there was a release of a video during the week as well to continue to stoke, I suppose, the unease now, the growing unease with Putin, this video of a palatial palace, a Putin palace on the Black Sea.
Well, yes, this was the bombshell, I suppose, that Alexei Navalny was holding onto until he needed to deploy it. And he dropped it just as he was arriving back here. So just after he arrived back here, this video investigation, his latest investigation, that's what his team does into corruption. And this time he targeted Vladimir Putin for the first time. And it was a video which claimed that Mr. Putin had built for him an enormous palace that was full of all sorts of crazily opulent things, including a toilet brush that apparently was worth some $800. Now, that was obviously supposed to anger people because corruption is an issue that really does get people's goat here. It was something that was reflected then on the streets, where some protesters came waving toilet brushes of their own, so objecting to the implication that there is corruption on a large scale here in Russia that goes right up to the very top. So I think, you know, the Kremlin has said this is nonsense. The Kremlin has said that the investigation is a joke and it's absurd that Putin has no palaces. He doesn't need them. And in fact, I've just been watching the big state TV news program from last night. I've just been watching it this morning online. And the whole thrust of that is to still present Alexei Navalny as a nobody and as a corrupt figure himself. Of course, he has been prosecuted in the past for fraud. He's only had suspended sentences in the past. He's called those cases themselves politically motivated. But now the question is, will the Kremlin turn the suspended sentences into real prison time for Alexei Navalny? And what might the backlash then be?
Because he is detained now for violations of probation. EU foreign ministers meeting today. There is a growing international outcry and calls for his release. But is there any sign the Kremlin might heed that and release him?
No, I don't think so. This is a Kremlin that doesn't give in to pressure of any kind, whether foreign or from the streets, I think the streets in particular. So no, I don't think he's going to be released. I suspect he is facing a real prison sentence, as it's described here. So his suspended sentence being turned into an actual period behind bars. And it could be several years that he's facing. I think it's a question of how long rather than whether or not he goes to prison. I mean, okay, up until now, he's only ever been detained by police, but this is prison time that he's facing. And I think that's the Kremlin making a new calculation that they need to basically remove the threat of Alexei Navalny.
Sarah Rainsford, BBC Moscow correspondent, thank you. Lots of good sport over the weekend. What with rugby and football? Darren Frell has all the details.
Yes.
Good morning, Darren.
Good morning, Mary. Really busy weekend. And actually, today is a very significant day also, because Andy Farrell, the Irish rugby coach, head coach, will name his squad for the upcoming Six Nations. So more on that in the next hour. I'll be talking to Bernard Jackman live just after the news at 8:30. But it was the last opportunity over the weekend for some players, especially fringe players, to put up their hands, make an argument for them to be included in that squad. And Connacht, I'm afraid, lost to Ospreys at the Sports Ground in the Guinness Pro 14, 26-20. Another home defeat for them. And this one will be really tough to take, because they actually led 17-5 at halftime. Brilliant performance from the Welsh side in saying that, but a very frustrating one for Connacht and their head coach, Andy Friend.
I didn't think we started that well. I thought we worked our way into the game, and you know, to get that score in the extra time of the first half, I thought was a real bonus for us. They get a yellow card. We come in at halftime, 17-5 up. That's our game now. That's our game for the take. And so we spoke about that. Spoke about being really smart and putting them to bed early instead of us scoring, and you know, when they get 14 men, they're scoring, they're touching down, and that just swung the whole momentum. So, you know, you get a side as good as Ospreys are, you get them in that position where they're on the ropes, you've got to finish them off, mate, and we didn't, and we paid the penalty there.
Now, in soccer, in the FA Cup, lots of goals to tell you about. In fact, there was three goals or more in all the games played yesterday, which was really good. Manchester United beat Liverpool 3-2 in the big one. They advanced to the fifth round of the FA Cup. Great match, just really ebbed and flowed throughout. Mo Salah scored twice for Liverpool, put them in front, but Mason Greenwood equalised. Marcus Rashford put the home side in front before Salah equalised. But then the winner came late in the game. Bruno Fernandes came off the bench and scored an absolutely brilliant free kick to seal United's passage. More on that in the next hour as well. Tammy Abraham scored a hat-trick as Chelsea beat Luton 3-1. Everton beat Sheffield Wednesday 3-0. And Leicester came from behind to beat Brentford 3-1. And Burnley 3-0 winners against Fulham. Rhianna Jarrett was on target for Brighton yesterday in the WSL. But unfortunately, her side lost 7-1 to Manchester City. Rory McIlroy just came up short in his bid to win the Abu Dhabi Championship. Tyrrell Hatton overturned his overnight lead to win it on 18 under par, four clear of his nearest challenger. McIlroy finished back on 13 under in a tie for third place. Here's what he had to say after his round.
Started well, started great with, you know, two birdies in the first three, and then felt like there was a few putts I hit today. The wind affected the putts more than maybe the last couple of days. I don't feel like I played great this week. I was sort of managing my game a little bit. So there's still, you know, it's nice to get a competitive week under my belt and know where my game is and see what I have to do to try to keep on improving. And, you know, thankfully I'll get on the plane tonight and head over to Torrey Pines and tee it up there next week.
Now, Darren Clark made a back-to-back victories on the PGA Champions Tour, won the Mitsubishi Electric Championship in Hawaii. Afghanistan beat Ireland by 7 wickets, so Ireland lose that best-of-three series. Always going to be tough for them to get an automatic place at that World Cup in 2023, and that result puts a big dent in that dream. Finally, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers beat the Green Bay Packers, while the defending champions, the Kansas City Chiefs, got the better of the Buffalo Bills to advance to the Super Bowl. The Buccaneers quarterback Tom Brady will play in his 10th Super Bowl on the 7th of February. That is your sport for now. Back to you, Audrey.
Could social workers be a vital link for families whose loved ones are in nursing homes? The Irish Association of Social Workers say they should be sent in to help communicate with families. They say there's been a breakdown in contact, particularly during distressing times for nursing home residents. Cian McCormick has the story and he joins us now. Cian, tell us more about what the association is calling for.
Well, the Irish Association of Social Workers wants HSE social workers to be part of those COVID-19 response teams that are deployed into nursing homes during the pandemic, as you were saying. It also says that this is needed so there can be a clear communication link between distressed families, the nursing homes and residents. Here's Sinead McGarry of the Irish Association of Social Workers.
Last April in wave one, the innovative work of social workers, HSE managers and some public nursing homes resulted in the redeployment of social workers into nursing homes. And those social workers provided crisis support and communication care for the length of the outbreak. It received really positive feedback from families and care staff. On the basis of the work that was done within those public units, the Irish Association of Social Workers developed a liaison model, which we have promoted and presented to the HSE. We've written to government in relation to rolling this out on a national level, because we believe that all residents and all families should have equitable access to the kind of crisis support and communication care we're promoting.
The Irish Association of Social Workers has written to the Minister for Health and the HSE about this. It's also calling for clearer guidelines for families of residents so they know exactly what the rules are in terms of visiting sick or dying relatives during lockdown. Again, here's Sinead McGarry.
The national guidance is dense, it's complex, and we haven't provided any plain English guides for residents or families. We also don't have any information in that guidance for families should nursing homes refuse to work with the spirit of the guidance or comply with the recommendations that are contained within it. So families have found themselves being unable to comfort or connect with their relative in the final days of their lives because in some cases they can't contact the nursing home because it's so overwhelmed. For families who are getting in to spend time with their relatives at the end of life, Some are saying that it's at a very late stage when the person is unaware of their presence, and it's causing huge distress and huge upset, because we have to remember that these are residents and families who've had a prolonged period of separation over the course of almost a year now. So for some family members, this may be the first time that they're seeing them or physically connecting with them.
Very real impact on families. Sinead McGarry talking to you there, Cian, and you've been talking to some families.
Yes, Audrey. For example, one family I talked to said they needed that clearer information about visitation rules when their mother was dying. And also the people I spoke with were part of a group on Facebook run by families called Care Champions. Here's Magella Beattie from that group.
Some people are saying we are so thankful when a phone is actually answered. Because nursing homes are so overrun at the minute, there is nobody to contact. And when there's an outbreak in a nursing home, families are overly worried, and rightly so. So there needs to be an individual advocate in a nursing home or liaison officer that family can contact, who will work with the family to let them know what's happening, to give them updates.
That's Magella Beattie there. So what are the nursing homes saying, Cian?
Nursing Homes Ireland agrees it's a good idea to have social workers as part of COVID-19 response teams. Here's its CEO, Tadhg Daly.
What we need to ensure now is, given the pressures on the entire health service and indeed nursing homes, that all available resources are deployed. And that's ultimately a matter for the HSE in terms of the supports that they are in a position to provide to nursing homes.
And what the Irish Association of Social Workers is looking for, they also say that there are also needs for clearer guidance for families. Do you think it should be made clearer?
Well, there's very, very good communication now between nursing homes and residents ultimately, but also families. I mean, the visiting restrictions that we've seen over the last while are there as a result of the Health Protection Surveillance Centre guidance. And if people are looking for more guidance, then that's a matter for the HPSC, the Health Protection Surveillance Centre.
That's Tadhg Daly there from Nursing Homes Ireland. The Social Workers Association say that they have written to the Minister for Health and the HSE. Any response, Cian?
Yeah, a spokesperson for the Department of Health said it has continuing engagement with the HSE and Nursing Homes Ireland, and it added the redeployment of social workers is a matter for the HSE. The HSE said it's open to reviewing the Irish Association of Social Workers' proposals. However, it also pointed to the recommendations of the expert panel review for nursing homes, which includes that each nursing home provider takes a lead role to ensure dedicated staff facilitate communication with residents and families.
Okay, Cian, thank you very much. Cian McCormick there reporting for us. It's 7:45.
Is it now an unstoppable conversation, as the Deputy First Minister Michelle O'Neill says, or is First Minister Arlene Foster right when she says it would be absolutely reckless at this time and incredibly divisive? We're talking about a border poll. A Sunday Times poll found a slim majority, 50.7%, favour a vote on whether Northern Ireland should stay in the United Kingdom taking place within 5 years. We're going to discuss this now with the DUP MP Geoffrey Donaldson, as well as the pressing issue of COVID-19 and why an All-Ireland approach is still elusive. Good morning, Geoffrey Donaldson.
Good morning.
And to COVID first, we're in a health emergency. We've been told that speed trumps perfection. So what additional and new measures would you and your party support now to keep, numbers have gone down north and south, but there is still tremendous pressure on our hospitals and ICU. So additional measures north and south that you would support in cooperation to keep those numbers down?
Well, the Northern Ireland Executive announced that they were extending the current lockdown period for a further month until the 5th of March, which means many of the restrictions currently in place will continue, and that's despite the fact that the infection rate, the R rate in Northern Ireland is now down to about 0.8 or less. But we recognise that given the ongoing pressure on hospitals, there is a need continue with these restrictions. In terms of North-South cooperation, our Minister of Health some 9 months ago asked the Irish Government for access to the traveller locator forms that indicate and provide information about the travel of people coming into the Republic of Ireland and travelling on into Northern Ireland. And Unfortunately, 9 months later, we still don't have access to that information.
How is that progressing?
Well, at the moment, it's with the Irish government. We are told by officials in the Irish Civil Service that this is a political decision that needs to be made. So we're waiting for someone in the Irish government to make that political decision and to allow the sharing of this information within the common travel area.
And what can be done north of the border to stop travel through Northern Ireland and on into the south of the country?
Well, of course, there are people who travel across the border every day for their work and other purposes, and I'm not sure that there is any appetite for stopping that travel where it is essential. Obviously, we, at the moment, with the restrictions in Northern Ireland, discourage non-essential travel, even within Northern Ireland itself. So we would certainly be in a position that it's only if people have to make an essential journey that they should be travelling from Northern Ireland into the Republic of Ireland.
Do you dispute that it is still happening, that people and over Christmas and beyond, people flying into Belfast and then travelling south? And is there more that you can do?
Well, I don't think the numbers are particularly high. The number of
you just need Geoffrey Donaldson, you really just need one super spreader to create a major problem, as we now know and as we're learning all the time.
Yes, but at the same time, the idea that we would completely stop flights or ferry services between Great Britain and Northern Ireland just isn't tenable. You know, we are linked into the UK economy. For example, as an MP, I have to travel to London to attend Parliament. So, you know, you'd have to shut down your entire public sector infrastructure between Great Britain and Northern Ireland to completely prevent travel. We need those vital ferry services coming across the Irish Sea and the air links that we have into London and Manchester and Glasgow are very important for our economy. People need to make essential journeys, and bear in mind at the moment it is only essential travel that is permitted across the Irish Sea. So we're simply not in a position to ban essential travel within the United Kingdom any
what
more
about
than the Irish government would want to ban essential travel, between Cork and Dublin.
The all-island approach still seems elusive. Alan Kelly, the Labour leader here, suggesting policing on the border within 5 kilometres of the border?
Well, of course, that is a matter for the Irish government, and if they want to take unilateral action to do so, of course, that is their right. And if they feel it's prudent to have checkpoints along the border or in close proximity to the border, that is a matter for the Irish government.
It could well be a decision taken out of your hands. Boris Johnson, this week, the Financial Times reporting, considering mandatory quarantine now for all travel arrivals. And, you know, it happened in Scotland where Nicola Sturgeon banned essential travel, or non-essential travel, I should say, from other parts of the UK over Christmas. So the decision could be taken from you.
But we've already said that people should not travel across the Irish Sea if it's for a non-essential journey. And we also currently require people who have been on a non-essential journey entering Northern Ireland from outside of the UK to have a period of quarantine. So we already have measures in place in Northern Ireland for this.
Just a quick comment on the latest numbers from that survey in the Sunday Times on a border poll, 50.7 favouring it within 5 years, and increasing growth as well in Scotland towards another referendum for independence. Are you looking at the breakup over the next decade of the Union?
I don't believe we are. If you look at and examine in detail these poll results, you will see that the result you've just quoted, if you take the margin of error, it may well be that actually there isn't a majority even in that poll supporting a border poll. And furthermore, when you break it down into the various sectors, some of the claims that a majority favour a border poll is only when you take out the people who don't know. So I think that at the moment there isn't a consensus in Northern Ireland for a border poll. And when you consider that we're in the middle of a pandemic, that our economy is under enormous pressure, that we have many priorities within the Northern Ireland Executive, but primarily about saving lives and saving jobs, I don't think anyone is going to push forward a border poll in the midst of all of this kind of situation.
Geoffrey Donaldson, DUP MP, thank you.
A new report from Oxfam claims the fortunes of Ireland's billionaires has risen 3.3 billion euro since the start of the pandemic. The report called The Inequality Virus has been published to coincide with the opening day of the World Economic Forum's Davos agenda. It highlights how COVID-19 has the potential to increase economic inequality in almost every country at once. Jim Clarkin is chief executive of Oxfam Ireland. Jim, what increases in economic inequality are we seeing in Ireland?
Good morning, Petula. It is important to mention that it is a global report. So what we're seeing is that Ireland mirrors the rest of the world, and that the billionaires in most of the world have increased, or certainly they have eliminated their losses of the pandemic over the first 9 months of the pandemic, and the Irish billionaires have increased their wealth. So this is an ongoing series of work that we've been doing, tracking billionaires across the world over the last decade. And what we're seeing is the wealth continues to rise in that place, and we're seeing that the devastating economic impact for the poorer parts of society and for the rest of society are having the impact immediately. So there is this growing inequality, which the IMF, the World Bank and many others are saying are completely unsustainable, is continuing, and it's continuing at pace.
Is the virus having a disproportionate effect economically on women?
For sure it is. And let's remember that 70% of care work and of essential work and of low-paid work in the Irish economy and similarly across the globe is carried out by women who are lower paid, who are in more precarious work, who don't have oftentimes the kind of benefits that one would expect from higher paid jobs. So it is having a specific impact on women across the globe.
And then globally, is Oxfam seeing inequality in terms of access to vaccines?
Well, we now know that many countries are hoarding vaccines, and the amount of vaccine that has been created so far has been largely managed or held by the richest part of the world. So we've been calling for a people's vaccine, whereby the intellectual property and the ability to generate the vaccines, which are amazing developments, should be shared and pooled, so that generic companies in developing countries should also be able to access that technology, so that we can get vaccines to everybody this year. Otherwise, we're going to have a situation where some parts of the world are vaccinated and other parts aren't. It's disproportionately affecting poorer countries and poorer people, which is unjust and wrong, but also it has the potential to continue this pandemic, you know, across the world and continue mutations, etc. So it needs to be addressed immediately.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Jim Clarkin, Chief Executive of Oxfam Ireland, thank you for your time this morning. I'll have more business news at 8:30, including news that Boohoo has bought the Debenhams brand and website for £55 million.
It's time for the weather forecast. It's cold out there. Matthew Martin is at Met Aaron. Morning, Matthew.
Thanks, Audrey, and good morning here from Met Erin. Well, yes, it is bitterly cold outside this morning with widespread frost and ice, and snow is still lying in some areas. We have a status yellow ice and low temperature warning in effect for this morning, with hazardous conditions on untreated surfaces, so take care when making essential journeys this morning. It looks like the cold snap, though, will come to a close by tomorrow, as milder air begins to push in from the Atlantic, and the weather is set to become quite unsettled for the week, with plenty of rain expected. However, early signs suggest it will turn colder again for the weekend. But for this morning, frost, ice and any patches of freezing fog will be slow to clear, but most of the country will be dry with spells of sunshine and just a few rain or hail showers, possibly affecting parts of West Connacht and North Ulster. However, cloud will increase from the west during the course of this afternoon, with patchy rain developing in western counties later this evening. After a very cold start, afternoon temperatures today will range from between 3 and 7 degrees. So frost will develop for a time early tonight in the north and east, but rain across the south and west will turn heavy and persistent early in the night and then extend across the country, preceded by some wet snow or freezing rain for a time in Ulster. Minimum temperatures tonight of -1 to 3 degrees and freshening southeast winds. It will then be a wet start for tomorrow, Tuesday, with outbreaks of rain and some sleet on northern hills. But rain will soon become confined to northeast Ulster during the afternoon, as generally drier conditions develop elsewhere. But remaining rather cloudy overall, with a few patches of drizzle about. Staying quite cold in Ulster on Tuesday, with highs of just 3 to 7 degrees, but milder elsewhere, with highs of 8 to 11. And briefly looking further ahead, Wednesday looks set to be a cloudy and breezy day with spells of rain and a risk of local flooding. It'll be mild on Thursday with rain clearing to leave it drier and brighter for many, but rain will return to the south coast later. And early indications suggest it'll turn colder again for Friday and the weekend. But just to recap for today, cold and icy this morning, but generally dry today with sunny spells and just a few showers in the northwest. And a reminder that a status yellow ice and low temperature warning remains in effect this morning, with hazardous conditions on untreated surfaces. That's the forecast. Thanks for listening and have a good morning.
It's 8 o'clock. This is Morning Ireland with Audrey Carville and Mary Wilson. The news now in detail with Brian Jennings.
The government COVID-19 committee will meet today in advance of an expected decision tomorrow to keep the current health restrictions in place next month. The issue of mandatory quarantine for some arrivals here is set to be considered. Our political correspondent Micheál Lehan.
The official government position is that all options are up for discussion today. However, while a period of mandatory quarantine for arrivals here without a negative COVID-19 test is high on the agenda, such a measure for all people entering the state doesn't appear to have the backing of government. There is likely to be a discussion about mandatory quarantining for those arriving from South Africa and Brazil, along with other countries where variants of the coronavirus are prevalent. Increased Garda checks at airports to curb non-essential travel is also on the cards. Plus, there is set to be a stepping up of checks to ensure people are self-isolating. Several political parties and public health experts want the government to go much further and quarantine all arrivals into the country. Today's deliberations will also focus on when schools might reopen, with the Taoiseach signalling at the weekend that all students won't be back in their classrooms by St. Patrick's Day. A decision on how the Leaving Cert exams will be organised this year is also due very soon. All this will take place against the backdrop of an anticipated Cabinet decision to keep the current Level 5 restrictions in place for at least another month.
Yesterday evening, the Department of Health said it had been notified of 23 further deaths from COVID-19. There were 1,378 new confirmed cases. The 14-day incidence rate per 100,000 of the population stands at 840.7. An article of impeachment against Donald Trump will be sent to the United States Senate today, paving the way for his trial next month. The former president was impeached by the House of Representatives 2 weeks ago, with Democrats accusing him of inciting his supporters to storm the Capitol building. Our Washington correspondent, Brian O'Donovan.
Donald Trump was impeached by the House of Representatives earlier this month, charged with incitement of insurrection after being accused of encouraging his supporters to storm the Capitol building. The article of impeachment against him will be sent to the U.S. Senate today. Senators will be sworn in as jurors tomorrow, and an impeachment trial will begin in 2 weeks' time. Meanwhile, the new president, Joe Biden, is today expected to formally reverse an order issued last week by Donald Trump, which called for the lifting of COVID-19 restrictions for those travelling to the US from Ireland, the UK, parts of Europe and Brazil. The new administration has said now is not the time to be easing travel bans, and South Africa is expected to be added to the restricted list. Brian O'Donovan, RTE News, Washington.
The National Security Council in the Netherlands will meet today to discuss its response to a weekend of anti-lockdown riots. Dutch riot police used water cannon and tear gas to clear demonstrators protesting against coronavirus restrictions. Hundreds gathered in central Amsterdam, while in the city of Eindhoven, dozens were arrested during disturbances near the central railway station. Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who's been criticised for playing down the seriousness of the pandemic, has tweeted that he has tested positive for COVID-19. He said his symptoms were light and that he's receiving medical treatment. A new report from Oxfam claims the fortunes of Ireland's billionaires has risen by over €3 billion since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. The report also says that while the 1,000 richest people in the world suffered losses due to the economic upheaval, they had recouped them within 9 months. But the charity predicts it may take more than 10 years before the world's poorest are able to recover from the economic impacts. Now the weather.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Super Value. Get thousands of really low prices in the Super Value range. Available in-store and online. Believe in low prices.
A bitterly cold and icy start this morning with hazardous conditions on untreated surfaces. Frost, ice and any patches of freezing fog will be slow to clear during the morning. Most of the country will be dry with sunny spells. But there will be a few rain or hail showers in West Connaught and North Ulster. Patchy rain will develop in the west this evening. Highest temperatures 3 to 7 degrees.
Plans to introduce tighter travel restrictions. The counties that have been hardest hit economically by the pandemic and the sale of the Lizard estate in West Cork are some of the stories covered on your front pages this morning. The Irish Times and Irish Examiner both lead with the line that ministers will today examine whether to intensify checks on people quarantining at home after travel, with fines under consideration for those found not to be complying with stay-at-home obligations. For its lead story, the Irish Independent reports on central bank figures on the counties that have been hardest hit by the pandemic. Kerry, which has a high dependency on tourism, was the county which was worst affected, with an unemployment rate of 25%, compared with 17% in Cork, where more people work in manufacturing. The Irish Daily Mail leads today with the story about an unnamed NHS doctor who was turned away from a Ryanair flight from London to Dublin on Saturday, despite having a negative PCR test, which he had done with the NHS. Ronan Smith reports that Ryanair staff insisted that the man needed a private test result to fly and that he was one of 9 people turned away from the flight. The Irish Daily Mirror leads with comments made by HSE boss Paul Reid on RTÉ's This Week programme yesterday, in which he said that 8 hospitals have reached capacity and that there are only 24 ICU beds available in the system. For its lead story, the Irish Daily Star reports on an incident at a checkpoint in Donegal town yesterday afternoon, which resulted in Gardaí chasing a car which failed to pull over when requested, and the arrest and subsequent release of 2 men and 2 women. And that paper also reports that Gardaí issued fixed penalty notices to 10 people who were found drinking in an illegal shebeen in an industrial premises in Swords in North County Dublin on Saturday night. The Irish News leads today with political reaction to the Lucid Talk poll carried in the Sunday Times yesterday, which found that 51% of those surveyed would favour a border poll. McGregor's €6 million kicking, that's the lead headline in today's Irish Sun, about Conor McGregor's earnings from his first ever knockout in an MMA fight over the weekend. As for this morning, The Independent is a front page story about a defamation case being taken against the governing body for competitive Irish dancing by 5-time world champion 32-year-old Jamie Hodges, who claims that he was blacklisted over false allegations that he sent a sexually explicit video to 2 girls. The HSE has purchased and distributed almost 50,000 pipes used to take crack cocaine since 2016 as part of the government's harm reduction strategy. That's on the front of the Times, as is a story about the Georgian Society's opposition to the ESB's desire to convert a house on Fitzwilliam Street in Dublin, which previously operated as a museum, into luxury apartments. And finally, the Examiner reports on its front page this morning that the Lizard estate in West Cork has just been sold to US buyers who plan to continue to run it as a boutique hotel for an estimated €3.5 million. The 163-acre estate, which has 2 period properties with 25 guest bedrooms and a 35-acre lake, was originally put in the market for €7.5 million in 2016. Owned by the Stern family from Switzerland for the past 25 years, Lizard recently hosted a number of Star Wars cast members. Concerts have also been held there over the years, with Nick Cave and Patti Smith amongst those who have stayed and performed at Lizard. And Tommy Barker also reports that at the end of the Cold War, the estate was bought on behalf of the Swiss government as a potential refuge in the event of a Soviet invasion or a nuclear drift coming over the Alps into Switzerland.
This third wave of the pandemic is pushing our hospital system to the absolute limits. Latest figures from yesterday saw 1,930 COVID patients in hospital, 214 of them in intensive care, and another 436 COVID patients are receiving critical care treatment outside of ICU. Our hospitals have never witnessed anything like these numbers before, and according to Paul Reid of the HSE, he expects them to rise in the coming days. Individually, hospitals are doing everything they can to create space for patients and have enough staff to treat them. Over the weekend, Cork University Hospital put out an appeal to its staff to redeploy to its intensive care unit in order to deal with the surge. We are joined this morning by Dr. Orla Healy, who is Chief Operations Officer for South Southwest Hospital Group, which covers 10 hospitals in the region. Dr. Healy, good morning.
Good morning, Audrey. Thank you for having me on.
Well, you're very welcome. What was the picture in Cork University Hospital that led to this call going out over the weekend?
Well, at the outset, it's been exceptionally busy across all of the hospitals in the group. We had 420 COVID-positive patients in-house yesterday, with 40 in ICU. But CUH, as the largest and the busiest of the hospital, was under particular pressure. And it is acknowledged that it would have started at a relatively low number of ICU beds, given the size of the hospital and the range of ICU-dependent specialties there. And it's a hospital that would have struggled to recruit nurses even in the pre-COVID era. So the pandemic has put particular pressure on the system, and it's a combination of the numbers of very ill patients requiring critical care, and also the number of staff who are absent due to COVID-related illness. So yesterday there would have been 150 nurses out because of COVID-related absence, and 13 of those were ICU nurses. Now, while there would have been more ICU nurses absent in recent weeks, they've returned to work, and all other ICU trained staff have been redeployed to the unit in recent weeks. But on Friday, we needed to open an additional 3 beds in the unit. So at that point, we asked the multidisciplinary team to redeploy to the unit. And the response to that request has been quite overwhelming. Over 70 doctors and nurses from across the hospital and outside the hospital, including GPs and staff from other hospitals, have been rostered for duty. So there is a roster in place now for the next 10 days to cover the unit. As regards numbers in the hospital requiring critical care, yesterday we had 23 patients in need of critical care. 18 of those were on the COVID ICU and 5 were in the general ICU, because we do need to maintain non-COVID care also at this time.
And do you have any patients, Dr. Healy, outside of ICU who require critical care, who require assistance to breathe?
Yes. Yesterday evening, there were 6 patients on non-invasive ventilation outside of the critical care unit who were being reviewed on a daily basis by the critical care team. We've also been transferring patients from our Model 2 hospital. For instance, our retrieval service transferred 12 patients into CUH since the start of December. And we are transferring patients out to other critical care units. For instance, we've transferred patients to Kerry this weekend.
You're painting a picture of intolerable pressure on your system, on your staff. And I just wonder, is that sustainable if numbers continue to rise over the coming days?
The situation is being managed, and the rosters are staffed. We have beds and we have equipment. We have ICU staff. The preference would be to have qualified ICU nurses at appropriate ratios, one per bed. Clearly, we're at a stage where that's not possible. However, staff are working in tandem with and under the supervision of ICU qualified staff. However, we are dependent on the decreases that we're seeing in the community to be sustained in the coming weeks, because a proportion, patients are admitted to ICU, they stay in the ICU for long periods of time, and the patients who are getting sick now and who've acquired COVID in the last 2 weeks, a proportion of those patients will end up in hospital and in ICU as well. So while the situation is stable, it is under pressure, and we are dependent on the wider rates in the community, that decrease being sustained.
Mm-hmm. And what about vaccinations and your staff, Dr. Healy? Because Cork University Hospital was one of the first group of four hospitals who got the vaccine on the first day back in December. How many of your staff have been vaccinated since then?
We are fortunate to have vaccinated a high proportion of our staff. It was site-based vaccination program commencing in the acute hospitals. So we vaccinated in accordance with HSE protocols, prioritising frontline staff and then working out towards the rest of the site. And as one of your earlier contributors commented, virtually everybody on the acute hospital site is frontline at this stage, and with the rate of redeployment to across the hospitals, everybody is potentially in contact. So we conducted that. We vaccinated our frontline workers, so the majority of them would have been vaccinated at this stage, bar those who were unavailable at the time for one reason or another. However, it is an integrated vaccination program, and it is a program that we aim to deliver across the hospital and community, and we are working in partnership with our colleagues in the community. We deployed staff to a nursing home in crisis yesterday, and we admitted patients from that nursing home to three of our hospitals over the weekend. So there are frontline staff across the community who have yet to be vaccinated. However, we are in a fortunate position that many of our frontline staff in the hospital have been vaccinated. I should also mention, Audrey, that other hospitals are facing similar pressure, and similar efforts have been made in our other hospitals amongst the multidisciplinary team to put their shoulder to the wheel, as it were. So health and social care professionals in Waterford volunteered for duty last weekend and undertook tasks like feeding patients and general multitask attendant duties, and the medical team, surgical non-consultant doctor staff and consultants were on site yesterday to do similar work. So staff are making extraordinary efforts across all disciplines and across all sites in hospitals and the community.
They certainly are, and we are grateful to them, and we wish you and them well in the days ahead. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Dr. Orla Healy, who is Chief Operations Officer for the South-Southwest Hospital Group. It's 8:21.
The Cabinet's COVID-19 subcommittee, as we heard earlier, will discuss the possible move today to mandatory quarantining for people travelling here without a negative test, and for mandatory quarantining for people arriving from South Africa and Brazil, two countries which have reported new strains. We also heard the government is likely to discuss this at Cabinet tomorrow. But almost all opposition parties have already made their views clear on the need to increase measures for people travelling to Ireland. We're joined now by the Sinn Féin leader, Mary Lou MacDonald. Good morning.
Good morning, Mary.
How far would you and Sinn Féin go now on these travel controls and restrictions and the imposition of a mandatory quarantine?
Well, Mary, we've been saying for months now that we need an effective system of mandatory quarantine. And what we mean by that is that nobody should be coming onto the island bar for essential purposes. and that anybody coming onto the island, any part of it through airports or ports, should have a negative test. If they don't have a pre-arrival negative test, they should be sent back to from whence they came. Secondly, we need a second test, a mandatory test after 5 days being on the island, and we need a mandatory enforced quarantine. And anything short of that, and it seems that the government is proposing simply to quarantine those that arrive without a negative test, that is absolutely insufficient. And I'm very surprised at this stage that they don't realise that. Certainly NPHET and the public health experts realise this. We have to grasp this nettle now, and it needs to be very, very clear that only essential travel onto the island, and then a mandatory form of quarantine, and nothing will act as a more effective pushback on travel that is non-essential than a mandatory quarantine of 14 days.
So with or without a PCR test, you're recommending a mandatory quarantining. And I suppose
absolutely,
it's necessary to be clear about exactly what that means. It, does it mean, and is your understanding of securing people in accommodation and ensuring that they stay in that accommodation for the required time, whether that's by policing or other security measures? Some might say, even in a health crisis, that this is draconian.
I don't believe that it is, Mary. I mean, the reality is that we now have new variants and strains of this virus. We know that this virus will behave in the way that viruses do. They mutate, they adapt, they get ahead of us. We're trying to get ahead of it. And I think in circumstances where we are now into 2021, and there are people who haven't seen a day's work in almost a year, businesses are to the wall, and more to the point, people have been sick, people have been bereaved. I think now at this juncture, It is absolutely proportionate to ensure that those coming onto the island are tested pre-arrival, tested post-arrival, and that the quarantine isn't laissez-faire or a matter just of a hit and miss, which, let's be honest, has been the case up to now. That now needs to stop, and we need very firm and very secure arrangements. So I would be urging the government to move away from any kind of minimalist notion that quarantine is only for those who arrive without their negative test. It needs to be much more comprehensive than that. And of course, it goes without saying that for this to work, it has to be island-wide. So that poses now a real challenge for the government in Dublin to now very belatedly, I have to say, use its influence to ensure that the same stringent measures are in place for those arriving in Belfast or any point of entry north of the border onto our island.
You said, you anticipated my next question, you said use their influence. Alan
yes.
Kelly said yesterday that we need to start patrols 5 kilometres, he suggested, from the border to stop the travel north and south. If you're going so far as to essentially lock arrivals up for a required quarantine people coming into the south of the country, do you not need to go further with the measures that you're proposing for north-south travel?
Well, the first principle to keep everyone safe on the island is to understand that for the purposes of this virus and public health, we are a single unit. We're a single public health or epidemiological unit. And any idea that you can corral the virus into a corner of the island and keep the rest of us safe is very, very sadly misinformed. That's not the case. If there's a reservoir of this virus anywhere on our island, it places all of us in danger. So just remember, Mary, that the regulations and advice now is that people should not be leaving their homes bar for essential purposes. There are restrictions in the north, there are restrictions in the south. We're limited in how far you can travel even to exercise.
But you must
the
back them up with the power PSNI. Of enforcement.
The Gardaí and the PSNI have the powers to turn you back and to police that. And that must happen. Absolutely. We're currently in a situation where our regulations and restrictions island-wide, north and south, mirror each other largely. We are in a very severe form of lockdown. So therefore, there is no rational basis for sealing the border. And can I just say, Mary, in any event, the reality for so many people is that who are essential workers, who live particularly in border communities, but more widely than that, that we live on the island and that people for work and essential purposes move north to south. Nobody, by the way, should be travelling anywhere unless it's absolutely essential. That's the advice across the island. The real issue that we face now is travel onto the island from other places. And that now needs to be cracked. I have been saying from day one of this epidemic, and you don't need to be a public health expert to realise that to keep people on this island safe, you have to operate on an all-island basis. We got a memorandum of understanding between the two health departments. That has been only minimally applied. There's been no ambition demonstrated, in particular from the government in Dublin, to press that ahead. And then the issue of travel, I mean, we've been raising this time and time again, and the Taoiseach at this stage needs to go beyond making a couple of phone calls, and it has to be the decided objective of all of us who want to keep people safe, that we will achieve the kind of stringent measures that I've described, that they will be mandatory and that they will apply irrespective of where you land on the island, that we will resolve to keep our people safe.
Moving on to education and an acceptance, I think, now that we will not have education opened in any full sense this side of St. Patrick's Day. Are you still pressing for the opening of additional schools with additional education supports? And what about the traditional leaving cert? Do you think it's time to think again?
Well, perhaps just to say, I think we all realise that given still the level of community transmission, that there are real concerns for everybody across society, but for those in education as regards the safety of students, of staff, of SNAs and so on. And the challenge needs to be now, I believe, to establish in a planned way how that safety is secured. I think it would have been better, rather than making an announcement and a target date of St. Patrick's Day over the airwaves, if there had been a more complete dialogue with the stakeholders concerned. I don't think it's the way to do business to make an announcement like that over the airwaves in the first instance. It is important that special education and children and young people with additional needs and disabilities get the first attention. And I understand, and I very much hope that that is work that is ongoing, because I know for many, many families, the idea that those supports that those young people and children need wouldn't be available until St. Patrick's Day or later will be an unbearable level of stress for them. So Mary, the government need to do now what they should have done initially. They need to dialogue, they need to collaborate, and they need to plan. And as for the leaving cert, at this stage, it's unthinkable that the government would leave students and teachers in this state of limbo. It's very clear to me that there needs to be choice afforded to students, some form of continuous assessment. And then if possible, if it is possible to have leaving cert papers, then those that wish to take that paper in addition should be free to
there
do
we
so.
We must leave it. Mary Lou MacDonald, Sinn Féin leader, thank you very much. It's 8:30.
Boohoo has bought the Debenhams brand and website for £55 million, but the online retailer will not be taking on any of the company's stores or its workforce. Another online retailer, ASOS, said today it's in exclusive talks to buy the Topshop and Miss Selfridge brands from the administrators of Philip Green's Arcadia Group. Irish startup Luna has teamed up with Zip Mobility to roll out smarter electric scooters. The partnership is one of a number of deals agreed by e-scooter operators for Luna's groundbreaking technology, which uses artificial intelligence and camera technology to ensure better safety. Sky is partnering with National Broadband Ireland to bring ultra-fast broadband to homes across the country, with the first homes going live from today. Let's take a look at the currencies. €1 buys 88.9 pence sterling and $1.21.7.
And at 8:36, it's good morning again to Darren.
Hello again, Audrey. Well, the Irish coach Andy Farrell will name his squad for the Six Nations later today. The thoughts of Bernard Jackman very shortly on that. But first, let's reflect on the last chance players had to impress over the weekend. Leinster came from behind to beat Munster on Saturday night. Let's be honest, that one not a classic we were expecting. Great game yesterday, however, but I'm afraid Connacht lost 26-20 to Ospreys in the Guinness Pro 14. This is going to be a tough one for them to take because they were leading 17-5 at half time. Michael Corcoran's been chatting to a very frustrated head coach, Andy Friend.
It's meant to be our fortress. It's going to be hard to win here, but we've lost four on the spin here now, so we need to change that.
It's becoming a bit of a habit, unfortunately, at this stage.
Yeah, four is not acceptable. That's what it is. It's not acceptable, so... we need to be better, mate. Our next home game here will be Cardiff. They're a good side. You see, they've two wins on the bounce now, and that's going to be tough. But if we want to do the things we say we want to do, we've got to be good enough to beat any team here. So that's our next challenge.
Yeah, Andy Friend there. Bernard joins me on the line now. Bernard, can you hear the pain and frustration in his voice there?
Yeah, I feel sorry for him, and Andy's one of the most positive, controlled coaches that you come across, but you could just see that the last four home defeats have really got to him, and it's the manner of the defeats. They're just not helping themselves, and we've analysed and talked about the Bristol game and the Munster game where they were coming from behind and didn't really manage that those situations well. But yesterday they got off to a flyer, and to be 17-5 up at half time, you could only see one winner. But just a little bit of inexperience and maybe lacking a little bit of confidence as well, and they allowed Ospreys back into the game, and it'll definitely be a sore loss to try and overcome.
Sure. You were at Thomond Park on Saturday night, Bernard. What did you take away from that one?
Look, I just think Leinster at the moment, they don't beat themselves, and Munster did beat themselves, really, despite the huge amount of positives, despite having a great start and bringing a lot of energy to the game. Just, two missed goal kicks, allowing Leinster exit easily at a key moment of the game, and some ill-discipline when really they weren't under that much pressure, and probably too much over-enthusiastic, and Leinster just stayed calm. They trusted each other and found the one opportunity to score the crucial try, from that beautiful move off a line-out, for Jordan Larmour's try. But Munster will definitely feel they're getting closer, but they'll also be getting pretty sick of not being able to get the job done.
Sure, I have a feeling they could meet again this season, but that's for another day. Six Nations squad today, I'm sure Munster and Leinster players will make up the vast majority of it. But do you expect anyone to come out and do enough to force the way in there?
Yeah, look, I agree with you. I think it'll be a pretty tried and trusted squad. They finished well against Scotland in November, and there probably hasn't been too many guys putting their hand up. Like Sir Reece Ruddock has been in great form, but he didn't have a huge game at the weekend. Gavin Coombs actually was pretty impressive, but the back row is pretty settled and hard to break into. The one guy I think may come in is the young Ulster winger, Eton McElroy. Andrew Conway doesn't seem to be available for this squad and hasn't played the last few weeks, but McElroy has got some game time in Ulster and looked pretty dangerous. So he may get involved, but probably not near the match day 23.
Okay, Bernard, thanks for joining us. We'll have that news as it happens on RTE Radio. Also, check out the RTE Sport website and the news app as well for that breaking news. Manchester United have beaten Liverpool 3-2 to advance to the fifth round of the FA Cup. Great game this, really ebbed and flowed throughout. Mo Salah scored twice for Liverpool, actually put them in front. Mason Greenwood equalised, Marcus Rashford then fired the home side in front before Salah equalised. And then the winner came in the death, the last 10 minutes or so, Bruno Fernandes coming off the bench and whipping in a brilliant free kick to win the game. Let's hear from their manager, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
Fantastic to win games against obviously last year's champions, a fantastic team. And we've had good results over the last couple of years. But this time we've found a way that we believe in, the players believe in, and we're getting stronger and stronger.
They're absolutely flying it. Liverpool, on the other hand, that's back-to-back defeats for them. Huge game against Tottenham coming up in the league on Thursday. Also wins in the FA Cup for Chelsea, Everton, Leicester and Burnley. Rhianna Jarrett was on target for Brighton yesterday in the WSL, but I'm afraid her side lost 7-1 to Manchester City. Rory McIlroy just came up short in his bid to win the Abu Dhabi Championship. Tyrrell Hatton overturned his overnight lead. He won it on 18 under par, four shots clear of his nearest challenger. McIlroy was back on 13 under in a tie for third place. Darren Clark made a back-to-back victories on the PGA Champions Tour, winning the Mitsubishi Electric Championship in Hawaii. Afghanistan beat Ireland by 7 wickets to win the best of three series. They meet again tomorrow morning. And finally, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers beat the Green Bay Packers, while the defending champions, the Kansas City Chiefs, got the better of the Buffalo Bills to advance to the Super Bowl. The Buccaneers quarterback Tom Brady will play in his 10th Super Bowl on the 7th of February. That is your sport for now.
We're going to talk to our crime correspondent Paul Reynolds about an incident at a Garda checkpoint in County Donegal yesterday. Paul, what happened?
It happened at around 1:30 yesterday afternoon. A detective unit on patrol came across a Jeep with three men and two women in it. It appeared to the Garda to be driving in a dangerous manner, and they signalled to it to pull over, but it failed to stop. It rammed the Garda car a number of times before driving at speed towards the Tully Earl roundabout, which is on the main Donegal to Ballyshannon road. Now, the Garda say they carried out a managed containment pursuit. A Garda COVID checkpoint was in place at the roundabout, so when the Jeep arrived, it drove the wrong way round to try to avoid this checkpoint, but went off the road. The driver, a man in his 30s, fled and was pursued by one of the detectives. The Garda fired a warning shot, but the driver kept running. He hid in a nearby field, but was discovered a short time later by the detective, and a struggle ensued between the man and the armed Garda before more Garda arrived and arrested the driver. The detective sustained hand injuries, suspected broken fingers, was taken to Letterkenny University Hospital for treatment. The scene was also searched, as the Garda believed they saw items being thrown from the car during the pursuit. Now, the two men and three women who are from Northern Ireland were all arrested last night, brought to Ballyshannon Garda station. Four of them were released last night, and one of the men is due in court later today.
Okay, is GSOC involved?
Yeah, the Garda Ombudsman Commission has been informed because a shot was fired from an official weapon. They gave us a one-line statement last night saying they had received notification of a firearm discharge in Donegal involving a Garda incident. At this stage, they say they're doing early inquiries and have nothing further to add at this time. Now, the Garda suspect that the five people who are from Northern Ireland may have also breached COVID-19 restrictions. However, they did not issue fines in this case because a circular was sent to all Gardaí last week, and it states that these legislative provisions, i.e. the imposition of fines, are, quote, not applicable to the Gardaí to use on people from Northern Ireland.
Okay, Paul, thank you very much indeed. Paul Reynolds there, our crime correspondent, 844. The Cabinet will discuss whether or not to introduce mandatory quarantining for some people who arrive into Ireland this week. The suggestion is that those who do not provide a negative PCR test would be brought to a hotel where they would quarantine, the duration of which is unclear at the moment. There are increasing calls for such quarantining for all arrivals into the state. We are joined now by hotelier Elena Fitzgerald, who is also president of the Irish Hotels Federation. Elena, thanks for joining us this morning. Have your members had any discussions with government on this?
There has been no discussions with government on it. I suppose it's still very much a matter for government right now, Audrey, in terms of finding the best route forward. And, you know, there are, I suppose, complexities in terms of the border issue. So there has been no engagement so far. But we would be very much of the mindset that, you know, should government decide to introduce a mandatory quarantine, you know, there would be willingness there to provide the infrastructure to assist. However, it would be very much kind of a matter for individual hotels in terms of their suitability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How would it work? Would it be mostly hotels near the airports?
It's hard to know, but that's kind of the expectation. But it could also be in urban centres. Now, hotels have been used in terms of providing essential services all along. So there's nothing new in that respect. Also, in terms of the Fáilte Ireland guidelines for hotels, there's also an appendix there that kind of deals with, I suppose, restricting your movements. And there's a sense of how will restricting your movements compare to quarantine. You know, there's certainly going to be a revision, you know, if that's what I would expect. And it's then a question of, you know, the devil is in the detail in terms of how that can be done. But there is an expectation that it would apply to airport properties probably in the first, you know, where it's suitable, but equally urban centres. You wouldn't expect kind of a regional rollout to a degree. But remember, Audrey, the numbers that are flying in are actually very, very small right now. I mean, a huge change in terms of numbers. So it's not a huge amount per se.
And would you expect to rehire staff that you had been, that had been working at the hotels up until the pandemic?
Well, some hotel staff are still in employment in hotels, working from home, or, you know, could be providing security services, etc., which is an insurance requirement. So there may be a possibility that additional staff would be, I suppose, reinstated. But at the end of the day, it's very important to say that, you know, where hotels, I suppose, provided a fit for providing those services, there would be a change in guidelines, there would be a training process in place. And like always, you know, I suppose people who are vulnerable or don't feel that they can return to the workplace because of, you know, health concerns or other concerns that affect their working life, that is always taken into consideration, as has been shown since the beginning of this pandemic.
And would you expect, Elena, there to be increased security involved in order just to make sure that everything is being complied with?
It's certainly something that you would expect to be under consideration. Again, it's a matter for government to decide. But, you know, where there are increased guard powers, there is increased compliance. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, quarantine, I suppose, whilst it's not a huge jump from, you know, where we are now, it is in some respects. And at the end of the day, you know, whatever government puts in place in terms of suppressing the virus, you know, we want it to work. And where there is enhanced guard powers, that certainly helps to bring us further along that journey and restoring public health as much as possible.
And this could be an ongoing situation, couldn't it, depending on how things go with the pandemic and where we get to?
It could. And I suppose there's a lot of talk overseas, you know, in terms of particular strains or in terms of how policies are unfolding overseas. You know, we're very far away from where we were with the traffic light, you know, system in terms of, I suppose, travel. But travel is at a level now like never before. I mean, even if you think, consider the last lockdown, we're more restricted now. So there is a sense of, look, how long will it last? You know, if it becomes part of our infrastructure, you know, the legacy of that is, I suppose, something, you know, as an island nation that we have to take into consideration. But, you know, there's a lot of progress that can be made, you know, in the interim with vaccinations, etc. And it's just probably important to say, you know, our hotel and guest house community also, there's great willingness there as well to provide vaccination centres, again, if that helped to expedite the rollout of the vaccines.
OK, well, thank you very much for talking to us this morning. Elena Fitzgerald, President of the Irish Hotels Federation. It's just gone 10 to 9.
We're going to talk about prize buns because the prize fund linked to the popular prize buns draw is set to be cut due to the fluctuating financial situation taking place globally. Prize buns are administered, the scheme is administered by the National Treasury Management Agency, and our consumer affairs correspondent Fran McNulty can tell us more. They are still popular, Fran, but what is changing?
Well, Mary, they're more popular than ever. The change is in basically the interest paid and what is allocated to the prize fund. Last year, there was a 92% increase, Mary, in the amount of money invested in prize bonds. 19 billion is in state savings schemes, the various state savings schemes. 4 billion of that is in prize bonds. And the reason people are putting their money into them, your money is safe. There's around a €250,000 limit. Now, not many of us can afford to put that much in, but what you put in is secured. And that's more than some financial institutions will secure. And it looks like, you know, why people are saving and putting them into bonds is they're not spending because of the pandemic. People can't go out, they can't go on holidays, they're restricted in the kind of things they can do if they go to the shops. So, and there is a consumer sentiment out there in saving rather than spending, and people are concerned, so they're investing more. And what this will mean basically is that changes to the weekly prizes are to be adjusted. So there used to be four prizes of €250,000 in the last weekly draws in March, June, September and December. That's going to be the new setup, should I say, Mary? Excuse me. €250,000 in the last weekly draws in March, June, September and December. There used to be two €1 million prizes, and that means around €1 million has been wiped off the top of the prize fund. So if you're investing in prize bonds, the chances are you will win less.
So your money is secure. You had the expectation that you might be a winner, but these changes are now, they've now come into effect, have they? They are here and they are happening.
Yes, for the prize bond fund, that change has happened. So those top prizes in the draws are changing from here on forward. There are also changes, Mary, to some of the other state savings schemes. So the NTMA administers quite a number of schemes. People will be familiar with some of these terms: the savings certificates, instalment savings, national solidarity savings bond, post office saving bank deposit accounts. They're all to face interest rate changes, and they're all being cut. And as you were saying at the opening, Mary, the NTMA is saying the new rates are being put in place to reflect reductions in interest rates in both sovereign bond yields and in the retail savings markets. And they're pointing out that state savings interest rates were last adjusted in 2016. Of course, the prize bond fund was adjusted in 2017 as well. But they're saying they're just reflecting what's happening across the sector.
All right. Fran McNulty, our consumer affairs correspondent. Thank you very much. It's 7 minutes to nine.
And 10 miners are still missing in China after an explosion at the Hushan gold mine in Shandong province 2 weeks ago. 11, though, were rescued yesterday. A 12th died. We can talk to RTE's Yvonne Murray in Beijing. Yvonne, thanks for joining us this morning. Are there still hopes that these 10 miners can be found alive?
There are still hopes, and the rescue operation will continue, according to the authorities here. There were dramatic scenes yesterday, and people feeling very relieved because it was a very long wait. The explosion, as you mentioned, happened on the 10th of January, so some 2 weeks ago now, at this gold mine in near Yantai in Shandong province. It was a week before any contact was made with the miners, and they were 500 metres below the surface. Then on the 17th of January, the rescuers felt a pull on the rope that they had lowered down. And at that time, they realised that they had managed to make contact with the miners. At some stage after that, the miners managed to write a note, which was lifted to the surface. They mentioned that they were surrounded by rising water and they urgently needed medicine. That, in due course, was lowered down. One nice detail to emerge at that time was that in their subsequent communications, they thanked the rescue team for the medicine and food, but they asked if they wouldn't mind lowering down some pork sausages. They fancied to eat something a little bit better at that stage.
Very good. And how are they, those 11 that were rescued yesterday?
The first miner that was brought to the surface was perhaps in the worst condition of all of them. He had been on his own in a separate section of the mine. When he was lifted up, he was very weak. He had a blindfold to shield his eyes from the sunlight after, you know, so long underground. He was taken on a stretcher to the ambulance and then away to hospital. The other miners, though, seemed to be in a much better condition. The 10 of them who'd been trapped together, they appeared to be stronger. Many of them walking unaided, and they were kind of giving the thumbs up and thank you gestures to the cameras. And it's interesting, actually, I think a huge sense of relief for those miners, because they had been told it was going to take another 2 weeks for the emergency teams to be able to contact them. So to be able to reach them yesterday, a full 2 weeks ahead of schedule, was obviously brought a huge amount of relief.
And do the rescue services, do they know which part of the mine the 10 miners who are missing are in, Yvonne, at this point?
Unfortunately, they don't. So they are still unaccounted for, and they will continue to look. I think what gave people hope with this initial rescue operation was that they did manage to make that contact a week after. Now, at this stage, with no contact being made, hope is beginning to fade a little. Having said that, they will continue the operation. It should be said that mining in China is a very dangerous practice. Safety standards are consistently criticised, and there are hundreds of accidents every year. So unfortunately, this isn't a particularly unusual incident, but the fact that these miners have been brought to the surface unharmed is obviously seen as a good news story.
Absolutely. Is it a big operation? Are there many involved? And presumably it's people across the country are glued to it, are they?
Yeah, they are absolutely glued to it. And I think this one thing to point out is that the manager of the mine has been removed from his post. And the reason for that is because there was a delay in actually reporting this accident for a full 24 hours at the beginning. So that delayed the emergency services going down to begin their rescue operation. That's been heavily criticised. He's been sacked from his job, I presume, to make an example out of him to prevent similar things happening again. However, it should be said that this is not unusual. There's been another explosion in a separate area of the country today. Unfortunately, this is something that we hear a lot in China. Very dangerous work, and I'm sure it will continue as well because it's not as regulated as it should be.
Yvonne, great to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed, Yvonne Murray, RTE's correspondent in Beijing, on that attempt to continue to rescue 10 miners still missing in China after an explosion in a gold mine 2 weeks ago. It's a minute and a half to nine.